At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Around we go, playing that game. Sell move, you's be done. They want us to stay. Around we go, playing that game.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I'm here with two fascinating women from the Mobility Dog Rescue Group. MDRG, as it's known online. That's the easiest way usually to find it. It's dedicated to enhancing the health and effectiveness of mobility assistant dogs by providing resources and guidelines. Their focus basically is developing best practices for training and equipment and ultimately promoting the best well-being of service dogs. Educating handlers and professionals on effective mobility is very important to them. They bring a collaborative approach by bringing together experts from various fields, including veterinarians, trainers, breeders, and handlers. One of the founders, Katrina Baldry, is recognized as a leading authority in the service dog community, particularly concerning mobility assistance dogs. She loves to find and work on the gaps within the service dog community. She's a mobility dog handler. Katrina is the founder and owner of Boldly Designs. It is a woman-owned company in Colorado, and the gear is handmade with a lifetime warranty. They're the only company recommended for mobility dog gear, and where anyone should go who needs customization to use their gear with limited mobility, such as wheelchairs. They also manufacture and sell Atlas Leash. The Atlas Leash is a great leash for pets. Great leash for veterinarians to recommend as well. It's a multifunctional leash, over 8 feet long, has 12 different configurations, including hands-free and dual controls. Jane Chappelle, well, she was motivated by personal connections to veterans, aspired to breed health-tested golden retrievers and donate them to assistance dog organizations. Her vision materialized in January of 22 when her golden retriever Ginger had a litter of puppies, and she was able to donate three of those puppies to organizations. After she did that, she became concerned about the lack of adherence to best practices in training for mobility and tasks. Together, they collaborate with other professionals to establish MDRG. So just off that introduction, hello, ladies. How are you? A lot of stuff there just off the introduction. That's so incredible. As I told you when we briefed before, I really loved working with service animals. I was a mobility service animal, was the first service animal I was ever introduced to in fifth grade. Our fifth grade science teacher, she unfortunately wheelchair bound. But literally, she could probably hit 40 miles an hour going down those hallways, and you would just hear her screaming, "Get out of the way!" She had a pointer. That was her mobility service dog, was a pointer. Absolutely incredible thing to watch. So, when were you all introduced to the concept of in your lifetime? When was the first time you were introduced to mobility dogs?
So I guess I'll start. So I actually. For quite a few years, my family raised seeing eye puppies. So seeing eye puppies are guide dogs, but there is a mobility aspect to that. And then I actually raised a mobility assistance dog, raised and trained him about 10 years ago. And that was kind of my first experiences with mobility assistance.
My story starts pretty similar, actually. I was a puppy raiser for guide dogs for the blind when I was a kid. So that's what really got me into just the working dog world in general. After I started my business, I was in 2008, I was volunteering with some local service dog organizations because I noticed that people were getting all, that people using wheelchairs were getting all tangled up in their leash. And I just thought that there has to be a better way. Anyway, so while I was working with one of those organizations, they asked me to take a look at some mobility harnesses they had that help people balance while they're walking. Never heard of such a thing. Never heard of such a thing. So they brought me in and I looked at these harnesses. I looked at the dogs. The dogs hated them. They didn't fit right. Anyway, and they asked me if there's anything I could do to make it more comfortable. I'm like, I don't know. I'll try. Let me try that. And then after a little bit, they asked me if I would just design a better harness for them. And after declining the request about four times, I finally accepted it and just went down the rabbit hole. And that was the decision that changed my life, put me on this trajectory, was taking up that project to make a better harness.
It's just so crazy to me how, when it comes to animals in general, no matter what little pocket you fall into, it always starts as a child or as a youth or as your early teenage years. And it's usually has to deal with, I want to do something better for them. And I don't think you ever lose that either as you get older. If anything, you get more passionate about it. Like, what can we do better? What can we keep doing better? So you got together and you created MDRG. And what is your main mission with this with this organization?
I was going to say our main goal is to provide resources to support the healthiest and longest working life for mobility dog teams. So, you know, this is a long life for a mobility dog is going to positively affect their partner.
When I embarked on that project to design a harness, I really started doing my homework. I talked to veterinarians and orthopedic surgeons and the physical therapy, dog physiotherapists, rehab people, because I wanted to make sure I really understood what was going on and how the dog moved. And it just, you know, and over the years, I've just gone deeper down that research trail. And so I had collected a lot of information. Just as I was just wanting to do the best I could. And because of my work in the dog community, I sponsor a lot of dog training conferences. So I see a lot of people face to face, including some veterinarians. Some of the top veterinarians of working dogs were delighted to, you know, share what they know. And anyway, because I had all this collected, and I had worked with a dog. I have my own mobility dog. I needed a place to put all of this information outside of my head. So it was one way I just wanted to share what I know, because it doesn't do any good if it's just in my head. It does better if it's out in the world and people can access the information and also learn from it and do better by their dogs as well.
So what are some of the key guidelines you could give veterinarians when it deals with working with mobility dogs?
I'll start with a few, Katrina, if that's okay. One of the things is the health checks that should be done for a mobility dog. They should have x-rays done of their elbows and their back and lower hips. And actually something that doesn't seem very common, it's ultrasound of the shoulder tendons. So those are some of the key things that should be done before a dog starts any mobility work. Katrina, you want to take it?
Yeah. I don't think we've clarified. I just want to clarify that we're talking about dogs that provide mobility as balance and stability assistance for someone who's walking. So it's kind of a very particular type of mobility dog. It's really important that the dogs be fully mature and I know just commonly, your average person just thinks, well, they're a year old, they're full grown. Well, no. So I really would like the veterinarians to make sure their patients and their clients understand that the dog needs to be fully mature, so completely developed skeletal and muscular system. And with the large breeds that we work with, that's usually around two. And the later you can start, the better, because we don't want to be injuring or causing any pressure or tension on growing bones and joints. And it's something that I think just needs to be more widely known. And it probably is much more in the veterinary field than it is in the average dog owner
Yeah.
world, of course. But and the way the dogs move, the way these mobility dogs move is very different. And I think that's an important consideration to just be aware of, because these dogs have been trained to do really highly precise maneuvers. So they sidestep and they back and they pivot very differently than just your ordinary pet dog going for a walk. And so there's just a lot more going on with the dog's body. They're doing a lot more physical work. We just want to make sure that we're looking at the whole dog, make sure the entire dog is sound and put together well.
So, when you say larger dog, are you talking about weight, body mass, or are you talking about height, or both?
Both. So we really recommend that mobile, sorry. We really recommend that mobility dogs be at least 60 pounds if they're going to be doing some balance assistance. And that can be a range of height. The taller the better, really, because just physics, the taller the dog is, the less handle you need, the closer you are to the dog's center of gravity, the more stable it is, and the less work that dog has to do too. So really, the bigger the dog, the better. I typically see a lot of standard poodles, retrievers, German shepherds. Those are the typical common dogs. Of course, breed doesn't really matter, but and so those dogs ideally are somewhere in the 60 to 120 pound range. We do see some smaller dogs doing it, but they're doing it from a different, we accommodate what the dog is capable of. So like we're not gonna put any pressure on a dog that's 45 pounds, but he might be able to do guide work just fine. Some of the guide dogs are quite small and really good at it. So just the size depends on what kind of work the client, the partner needs as well. So you need to match the dog with the person's needs.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm glad you brought all, bringing all this to our attention because honestly, we learn a lot about orthopedic medicine, but we don't learn the specifics, especially when it comes to a companion that's used for mobility like that. Is there anywhere veterinarians can go, or are there any conferences, or are there any books if, especially because I try to reach out to the early career veterinarians, and of course, their brains are like a sponge, hopefully at that age, and they're trying to bring in as much knowledge as possible. So, are there conferences that you have, or are there, is there a book, or do you have newsletters you send out?
Well, Katrina, I think you've attended the Penn Vet Working Dog Conference. That's
Vet
probably
Working
a
Dog
really good
Conference,
one.
yeah, is also joining up with another another canine science group. So they're actually combining to be a bigger conference that's been biannual lately. And that is Dr. Cindiotto from Penn Vet Working Dog Center is one of the big names there, but she really has studied working dogs. And a lot of the veterinarians that I've talked to, they're coming in from the more like military and police working dog experience. But the dogs that we're working are under just as much physical demand and stress. And so there is more research for that type of working dog that we can also apply to the mobility dogs. We're such a young organization. We haven't done a whole lot of that yet. But the list of our resources, especially links to studies, et cetera, those are going to point people toward the research that has been done that I think is applicable. And a lot of it's way over my head because I'm not a scientist and I'm not a veterinarian. So talking to the people who really know it, of course, is the most important. PenVet has put together a lot of resources, and there's some some other groups in that orbit that understand that the physical demand component. One of the other veterinarians I worked with came from the military working dog world, and she also does search and rescue dogs. And she does mention at her when she talks at a conference, some of the things to keep in mind for any veterinarians that are seeing mobility dogs. And that's Elda Ford. She put the idea in my head that they move differently, so they're using their muscles differently. And so how their structure is working together is more specific than just, an ordinary pet dog that has bad hips. We just want to look, we're coming at it from a different angle because they're actually doing the physical
And
assistance.
there are a lot of research links on the website.
Yes. Yeah. And we point you to all those studies, and any of those groups that I have found that are useful. And as I find more, of course, we will add those. And if anybody has new information they want to share, send it because we want to share it.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the more information, the better. Because the one thing I'm trying to show, especially veterinarians that are having difficulty, is that you don't just need to be in a regular small animal, large animal practice. You can really get out there and specialize and find a certain niche that you really love and enjoy. And like I keep repeating myself, I think I've said it twice already today, there's nothing more rewarding than working with a service dog. You're actually helping two lives at once. So, I recommend everyone to try. If this is something that interests you, go and do as much research, go to some meetings and find out what you can, because there's a lot of good that we can do for everybody. So, interesting thing I was reading, and I was hoping you could help me with this. What, because you we talk about equipment. So it's one of the questions I had is when it comes to the harness, I was reading something about the harness that crosses the shoulders. Could you explain a little bit about that one to me?
This is my favorite part. Okay, so there's a lot of opinion about dog harnesses because it's very opinionated. But there's an idea out there that a harness that has a strap that goes straight across the dog's chest is restrictive, and that a harness that has the V shape is not restrictive, but fit is far more complicated than the shape of a given chest strap. What's more important is how that harness fits that dog, because dogs have very different conformation. A harness I put on a German Shepherd is entirely different proportion-wise to a standard poodle. Standard poodles are not built like anything else, and they are one of the breeds that do best with a low strap that comes up in a V. Oh, hi, Dalton. Nice of you to join us. That's Dalton. You said that I'm on the phone. Okay. Oh, thank you. Sorry, dog distractions. Because the poodle's shoulder joints sit higher than their thoracic inlet. So a strap that goes across the shoulder restricts both their airway, and their movement. But other breeds, you can run a straight, just different conformation. You can run a strap straight across, and it's below that thoracic inlet, and it's above the shoulder joint. So it's not crossing the shoulders. even though it is straight. So it, yeah, the how it's fit and how it's designed to fit that dog is far more important than just the flat out shape of it, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. And you gave me a lot more information than most of my clients get when they go to PetSmart and that 18-year-old is trying to fit a harness. So I,
Chris Zink has a lot of information on that. And some of her articles that she's written for lay people are the easiest to understand. So again, that's some of the links in our resource list is explaining how all that comes together and how studies have contradicted each other. It's really interesting.
So have you ever tried to get a harness on an English bulldog? Talking about crazy confirmation.
That I have not done.
There are some links to non-restrictive harnesses in the website also. We have several listed in there.
I'm going to point out that harnesses used for pet dogs that pull on the leash are intended to be restrictive. That's literally how they work. They're literally hobbling the dog so the dog can't move as fast. So, you know, what the harness is made for and its purpose will very much determine how it's shaped and where it adjusts.
Yeah, and I want to bring that point home because it's not just harnesses, it's all those different training collars that everyone thinks they know how to use or they should get. And I've seen some horrific, horrific cases from people who decided, hey, I'm going to use this the prong collar to train my little 24-pound dog. And it caused severe damage. The best is when they put the prong collar on and the prongs are sticking out. I've seen the harnesses as well. I've seen them come in and they asked me to put it on. And I'm like, I you know better than me, you know. But they're like, well, this, you know, they told me this was the best. But I think it's very important for veterinarians during the physical exam to always look at their collar, their harness. Is it too tight? Is it the right fit? Is it too loose? And harnesses in general are very, very, very hard to fit on a dog. And now you just shed the light, the whole concept of going across the thoracic inlet and cutting off not only the trachea, but also the jugulars. And if it's tight enough, the carotids, they could strangulate their dog, you know, with a harness, even though they think they're not going to be doing anything wrong. So I thank you a lot for that, because that's a very important point to bring home for all veterinarians out there, that a physical exam is more than listening to the heart and looking at the eyes and the ears. You got to just take the whole thing in. So I thank you for bringing that point to light and explaining that as well, because I was like, across the shoulders, but now I understand exactly what you're talking about, and I thank you for that. So let's talk about the tasks that your mobility dogs do. They do a lot of proprioception assist mobility, correct? Can you explain that to the listeners?
Okay. So proprioception, it's actually a way for the person to be more stabilized and also to kind of, for POTS patients in particular, which there are more of after the long or with the long COVID, it's for them to kind of not have to think about where each of their feet are going to be placed next. So the dog can help with that with a very minimal load bearing. It's a cue that's probably very, very much underused, because I think a lot of people don't know how to train it. But it can be very valuable as opposed to cue where there's more load bearing, like, you know, counterbalance or a momentum pull. Proprioception is, you know, I think the hardest thing is learning how to teach it, because it's kind of plot. So the dog doesn't really like that. They need to resist. It's called opposition reflex. They need to sort of resist when they're doing it, which is a little bit tougher to teach. Trina, you want to add to that?
Yes, yeah. So yeah, proprioception is more like just it's a touch to feel grounded. So you know, a lot of people, including myself, if I'm standing, I have my hand on the back of a chair or on a wall or on a counter. That way I know exactly where my body is. And the harness handle can do the same thing. So it's about a consistent place that you can touch to feel oriented. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I'm hoping most of my listeners understand proprioception. Because I mean, having that sense of like there's a condition in dogs called old dog vestibular, you know, where they get really dizzy. And if you put the dog on the back, on their back instead of their feet hitting the ground, they freak out because that sense of being grounded just totally calms the nervous system. And that's exactly what you explained. So question that I was thinking while you were talking about that, when they are not working, what are some CrossFit or other training they should do to make sure that their muscular system gets the full workout and you're not just working such particular joints and muscles?
We also have on the website, we have a section on fitness, which I think is what you're referring to, and why fitness is so important for a dog, because, you know, it's their core health and, you know, their endurance and everything that goes along with that. And there are recommendations for different fitness courses. Actually, Atlas has one that can be purchased, and there are several others on there. There's Fit for Work.
Fit for Work, yeah, is coming out of, excuse me, Fit for Work is coming out of PennVet, and that the collaboration with Cindy Otto. And hers doesn't use any special equipment. They literally use cinder blocks for a lot of their fitness and strength exercises. And then you can get fancy with the fit paws, you know, inflated, unstable platforms and all those fun things. But yeah, it's so important to keep them just healthy in general. But, you know, if you're let's say you're a hiker, you're not just going to go hike up the mountain without training first and without working those muscles. So we want to kind of do the same thing with the dogs. We want them to have the strength. The more strength they have in their muscles, the less impact it will have on their joints, because their muscles learn to do the work. My dog is very lazy. He will fall into his joints, but with the fitness exercises, he gets his posture right. And so then when he's in harness, he now stands in the correct posture, rather than being lazy. So,
was that the one that was on the screen? Was that the little guy that came on the screen?
I worry about these dogs getting enough exercise anyway, because we who need them are not physically able to, you know, walk or jog them like other people might be able to do with their pets. So finding a way to keep them fit, and so it can be done at home with some of these simple exercises from Atlas's course, et cetera.
How do you guys feel about swimming the dogs if they have access?
Yeah. Well, my dog swim. Loves it too. Yeah, it's he'll exercise himself at a lake.
I'm sure he will.
You won't get any proprioception help for a while either. I'm sure he's like, you just sit here on this bench. I'm going to go take care of myself for a while.
Yeah, my dogs use our pool more than anybody else in my house. So yeah, it's great, great exercise for them.
So either one of you use dogs for proprioception right now?
I do a lot of counterbalance as well. So combination.
How about getting help off the floor? Do they help with that?
It can. That's a little. This is when it becomes complex of what we're asking the dog to do. Jane, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so brace is the weight-bearing task that you would use to get off the floor. And that is a task that seems to have a lot of gaps with organizations training it, not really understanding everything that's involved with that, because the weight should never go directly onto the back of the dog or the shoulders of the dog. You should use other objects to help you get up, transfer your weight to a chair or something else as you're using the dog, you know, to give you some stability as you get up. But yeah, there does seem to be a lot of misinformation out there about that.
Yeah, we don't want to push on the dog. Pulling is a little different. So you can learn to get up off the floor by grabbing the harness and having the dog pull. So there's alternate ways to do it that's less, has a lower chance of injuring the dog, I guess is what we're saying. So especially if it's repetitive, the dog is not gonna replace you learning how to put your body in the right position and stand up, right? Physical therapy can help with that. But the dog can assist with maintaining that balance so that you can stand up without wobbling.
It's kind of like wakeboarding. That's what you made it just sound like. Like you just sit back there and you let the boat pull you up, right? The rope gets shorter, it gets taut, and it, boop, you pop right up. Exactly. It's so funny. The reason why I asked that is because I had a lady that, a client that bought a mini golden doodle, and she was going to use it to help her get up. And she stopped being my client when I said, this dog is not going to be capable of doing what you're asking it to do. And she was very offended. But that's another important point when it comes to the client-patient relationship when you're looking out for the animal, is that you got to know what that dog's probably capable of. So I'm glad you clarified that as well, because for the longest time, I thought I was in the wrong. But I can see where you're getting from. I mean, if you have like a Great Pyrenees or, a Rottie or something like that, that's made to pull and lift that much, or St. Bernard, perfect example, that makes sense. But if you have like a 70-pound Golden, there's going to be some limitations to, it's going to do everything, a Golden will do anything they can for their companion, but they will almost hurt themselves trying to do it. And you got to be careful about that.
Good point. These dogs are so stoic. They're not going to say no. They're going to do it because you ask them to. Even if it's not good for them, they don't know that. So that's up to us to make sure that our expectations are reasonable.
Yeah. So I mean,
the other question I have then is like, when do you know it's time to retire your mobility dog? It's a hard question. Hard question.
It is a hard question. And I think veterinarian that you trust can be a really important piece of that. Obviously, if you've been using a mobility dog to do load and weight bearing for years, they should be, there should be health checks that are being done in between. And the partner, the human, side of the partner also needs to be aware of changes that are happening, in the team. So I think all of that together, but like having a veterinarian that really can help guide you, in those kind of things. And, the age of the dog, are they slowing down? Because, like I said, that's what the Mobility Dog Resource Group really is about. It's to have like the longest, healthiest working life for the team. That's our, that's our goal.
And the health check recommendations that are part of our best practices and guidelines are directly from veterinarians. This is what they would recommend for these types of dogs that are doing this kind of physical work. So, your annual well dog vet visit is going to be a lot more intense than it would be for a pet. Every couple of years, we recommend doing x-rays again. Just make sure they don't have any osteoarthritis developing, because that joint is under a lot of load. And so it's, you know, breaking down faster. We want to be looking at that on a regular basis, not just the first time, but continuously.
So almost a semi-annual checkup would be better, because they age a lot quicker than we do. And their job is a lot more than, you know, a house pet or a house companion. I would think that would make a lot of sense. What are the biggest issues? Because I know veterinarians are going to want to know. Are they more prone to arthritis because they've been working so much? Are they more prone to tendonitis? Are they more prone to soft tissue injury, especially as they get older?
Really good question. There's not been any research on this, so we can't say definitively, because nobody's ever looked at long-term impact of mobility work. It's just, it has not been done. One of the really common injuries that comes out of, like, let's say police dogs, is front shoulder injury, because they're jumping out of the back of an SUV. Cold, right? They're not warmed up. They're not stretched. They jump out of the truck cold and they run. That's a huge impact. And if they do that several times a day, that's the kind of thing we're going to want to be looking for. So what, you know, what part of their body is getting the more repetitive?
You're telling me a Malinois actually gets cold? Those guys are on 150% all the time. I think the only time they turn off
a volume control. They're on or they're off.
Yes, man. Yeah. Cause I used to do a lot of work with the, I did Riverside search and rescue dogs. I did the LAPD, dogs, and I was doing the Laguna Beach, police dogs as well. And I mean, those guys were crazy. Funny story, talking about Malinois really quick and working dogs. They were so excited. They bought this special unit just for this, because they're just bringing a police dog in, and they bought a special unit. And it didn't take that dog more than 3 weeks to destroy the entire back of this. I don't even want to know how much they spent on this car. And it's like, yeah, well, this is the breed. This is what you get. And so, yeah. But I don't think, would a Malinois be a good breed for this type of work, do you think?
It can be, if the individual dog has the temperament for it. They're being bred for so much, military and protection work that they often just don't have the temperament for it. So, but some do.
Are you seeing a lot more doodles?
I think there are a lot more doodles as working dogs in general, just because of the allergy aspect of it. And some of them actually are really good size-wise. Katrina and I have talked about that. The one thing I was going to just say about the Malinois is service dogs, they have to want to work, but they also do a lot of settling. They just have to hang out, which also means, that they're lying on the pavement a lot, or on hot, hard surfaces a lot. They don't have the choice like a pet dog would to go lay somewhere else, which is another piece of the whole mobility dog and service dog.
So what recommendations do you give for people who live in hotter climates? Let's go extreme, Phoenix. And let's say they have a mobility service dog and they need to walk down the sidewalk. I mean, aren't their pads more susceptible to injury?
That's tricky. I haven't gotten a good answer on whether or not dogs should wear boots. Do they get hotter wearing boots? Because their feet are their cooling system? I don't know. We don't want to burn their pads. So yeah, there's sometimes I don't take my dog with me on a 100-degree day because I'm going to be on pavement all day. That's just not fair. But yeah, I don't think we really have an answer for that yet.
So let's talk about the training. What kind of training do you guys recommend for these working animals?
We don't really recommend training trainers in the mobility dog resource group. We do have harness task examples in there and the way that they should look when they're being done. But yeah, we don't personally recommend, you know, training. I will say that I am at the end of the service dog trainer academy for Atlas. And Atlas has this really great mobility, balance and mobility module, course, whatever, as part of that whole academy that can be purchased by trainers who are interested in learning how to train balance and mobility dogs the best way. There's a lot of information in that course that came out of recommendations, especially from Katrina, the content, you know, on the different tasks that are in that course. So I can say that.
And what we are always going to recommend is positive reinforcement based, because we want these dogs to want to work with us, not because they have to, but because they want to. The positive reinforcement just makes for a happier, healthier service dog. But we're not going to do the mobility, the advanced stuff like the harness training until they're two. But you know, up until that point, it's just, you know, as you would raise any puppy, good, you know, just good socialization, get the foundation training there. The last thing that's trained is the actual physical harness work. The rest of those 2 years is just, you know, learning how to be a good dog.
So going to the puppy stage and, you know, just the beginning of training, what type of trainer do you recommend? What should someone be looking for in a trainer if they want to get their animal into this type of service or any service at all?
I mean, I would say a positive reinforcement trainer, for sure. And I think in our mobility dog resource group, we do have some recommendations like for, you know, puppies and things that they should be learning, which would be good to, when you do find a trainer, to make sure that you can, you know, get recommendations on how to train certain things and what they're exposed to and all of that, because it's very important for a service dog that they're used to different surfaces and, you know, just be exposed to a lot of different types of things.
Different environments, lots of different people. Yeah. My recommendation is a fair kind of entry standard would be canine good citizens tests. You can find all sorts of trainers all over, you know, really anywhere that can help train for the AKC good citizen. And that's gonna, you know, and that's, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that? And so that's a good goal for someone to have early on when they're training a dog. It kind of, you know, at least sets them in motion in the right direction for that type of, you know, just happy, confident, well-behaved dog.
Yeah, it's all trust, right? Yeah, it's all trust. And you're trying to create a trusting relationship. Curious question. Have any mobility dogs, especially for POTS, ever been giving? I know there's the ADA that protects against service dogs and their owners, their handlers. But have you heard any horror stories of service dogs not being accepted anywhere?
All the time. It is a constant. If you handle a service dog, there is no easy in and out errand anymore. It's And you're like a big, you're like I have a big blinking neon light, like I'm disabled. And yeah, it does happen, and it happens regularly. And yeah, I wish there was an easy button solution for that, but there's not. Well, so a dog that can tolerate just about anything is what you're going to be looking for, because your dog will get tackled by someone's random three-year-old. You know, some old lady in the grocery store is going to yell at you. You know, it's just, it's what happens if you have a service dog.
You got to have thick skin. Because I mean, well, the reason why I asked that is because, you know, in my last couple years of practice, it seemed like every dog I saw was a therapy dog or a service dog because they bought the vest off Amazon. And what are organizations like yours doing to combat that stigma that, hey, they truly aren't trained as a service or therapy dog? Don't get me wrong. People use them for their anxiety and stuff, but they haven't gone through the proper channels and the proper training. They spent $250. They got a letter from some therapist who even knows if it's not AI.
Absolutely so, nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are organizations like yours doing to try to combat that stigma that, hey, this dog truly is a service dog?
Setting the example by having a well-trained dog that doesn't interrupt anyone else as they're going about, you know, as they're going about their day. And yeah, it's the behavior that's the difference. And I've kind of wondered if maybe we should tackle this from an animal rights perspective. Like, it's just not, it is cruel to force a dog into this kind of stressful work if they are not prepared for it. I don't think enough people put the dog first. So, but what we can do as an organization is set that example and help other people be good handlers with well-trained dogs. So again, we're setting the example of what it should look like. Some of the craziness is fading a little bit from my perspective, but yeah, it's a continuous issue, because you know people think they have to go online and get this registration, which doesn't mean anything.
It gets you on a plane,
and that's one of the most stressful things you can do with a dog.
It's stressful enough for us.
the stories you hear in the news of the dog that bit, or the dog that, you know, had an accident because they're stressed. They've been put in a situation that they are going to fail in. And that's a people problem, not a dog problem. In my opinion.
So let's talk about organizations. Because Katrina, I know you were a previous board member, and now I am a board member of Atlas Dog. Why is Atlas Service Dog so very important to the animal community, the service community, and people who need service dogs?
The need for service animals is so big. There is no possible way that any one model can serve everybody. And there's lots of really good training organizations that provide service dogs, and there's lots of not so good organizations that train service dogs. And there's also a lot of people who call themselves dog trainers that really just simply haven't had the experience and the knowledge to do the thing that they say they can do. And Atlas is trying to tackle that from both directions. We're trying to train dog trainers how to be service dog specialists. Jane can speak to that. And also help people that want to train their own dog but have no idea where to start, just really need support to get through it. So kind of a two-pronged approach that Atlas is taking.
Yeah, and with Atlas also, you may be able to shorten the wait time depending on, you know, where you're at and all of that, as opposed to waiting 4 years or whatever to get a dog through an organization. You're also building a bond with the dog as you're training the dog, which is super important. I think, and it also can be more cost effective to go through Atlas. So, and you're learning, you're also as a client, you're learning all the right things to do with training the dog and then working the dog, which I think is super important.
Something that you really can't do isolated on your own. I'm not the first person to say this. You really do need other people to help. You need someone to observe that, is not emotionally invested. Does this dog have the right temperament? It's really hard to see if your own dog is stressed or not. So it's and having that kind of guidance, like noticing where the training could be better, is super valuable.
Well, I think Atlas, Jean, you're talking about gaps, always looking for gaps. I think the biggest gap they're filling is the fact that most people don't have $30,000 to $50,000 for a service animal. And, and that's before you get into the cost of veterinary care, which has gone through the roof in the past few years. So, that's why I think that organization really is on to something big. And I'm very, very happy to be a big part of it now. So if the listeners wanted to get a hold of you or find out more information about your mobility information, what website should they go to?
MobilityDogResources.org.
And do you have that the Penn? Is it University of Pennsylvania, the vet school?
There is
Yeah, there's
information.
information from them because they have actually made public a lot of very, very useful information. And so we're just pointing you to resources that already exist because we don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time. There's some fitness stuff from Penn Vet that let's just send people, to the resource where that information is coming from. And yeah, Atlas, of course, as well. But yeah, mobilitydogresources.org. Tried to make it simple.
Guidelines document that's in the website, that when you kind of look at it, you'll see that that was vetted by and additional information was given by, some very specialized veterinarians, Dr. Cindy Otto and Dr. Ella DeFord, like Katrina had mentioned, and also the University of
University of
Colorado.
Colorado's veterinary hospital group. I work with their orthopedic rehab department. The rehab guru, man, they know their stuff. So that's a really good person to bring onto your personal veterinary team is somebody who's actually really studied movement, because that's just general practice veterinarians just don't have a specialty knowledge unless they have sought it out, right? So we just want to encourage people to use multiple resources as well.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I could think of physical therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic. I'm not sure about. But one question I thought of, and I don't know if you'll have the answer to, was a lot of these dogs, these breeds you mentioned, they're prone to tearing ACLs. Have you had a lot of issues with ACL? And if you have, how do they do post repair?
I don't personally know of, excuse me, a mobility dog that had an ACL tear. I actually have a pet dog that had an ACL repair, and she went through the whole physical therapy, and she does great now. It was 2 years ago. But that's one of the reasons too, I think, why the health checks and all of that are so important. Doing all of that at the beginning.
Don't have personal experience with it, but I do understand that there is a connection between early sterilization and ACL tears because it alters removing the hormones alters the way they grow. So one of our big recommendations is to wait to sterilize a dog until they are more mature, if not completely mature. Especially for mobility dogs, because we need their body to be so physically sound. And rescue dogs can do great, but some of the rescue dogs are sterilized at, very, very young. And so I would kind of just be aware of that if I was selecting a dog too, because it puts them at a higher risk as well. That's something else that I think the veterinarians should know too, is to really encourage for this type of dog, encourage them to not neuter it early.
Exactly. No, working dogs especially, I understand the musculature on the male dog because of the testosterone. Female dogs, once they go through a heat cycle, I don't know how much testosterone's left. But that is the recommendation that's been coming out now, is let them get through a heat cycle, neuter after at least a year of age. If not for your dogs, I would think after growth plates were closed.
I would say 18 months minimum, was what I've heard from the professionals I've worked with.
Sounds good. Just all great information. And again, like I said, to the listeners, this is just one of a few great organizations that are out there that you can get really involved with and make a difference. And I hope you do. And I hope you guys tune in next time. We'll talk soon.